Thanks, Deborah. Very much likewise. I just wanted to start with a very brief announcement that we messed up. We forgot to put Danny Kalupak on our thank you slides. He's been the ethics deputy this year, and we would like to specifically thank him for his contributions. I want to be really short because I think we're, as Deborah said, we're here to listen to Professor Patel, and I would just like to introduce him. It's not easy to introduce Vikram in a short way because of his many achievements. He's a psychiatrist at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine and is with the Public Health Foundation of India as well as Sangat in Goa. And really, and he's the co-director of the Center for Global Mental Health in London. The main reason we invited him was because we feel there's a lot to gain by bringing together the world of global mental health, of which Professor Patel is a leader, if not the leader, and the world that that we represent in this room. So, global mental health, its key characteristics really are that it's focused on narrowing the gap between mental disorders and the availability of treatment across the world. That second characteristic is that knowledge should flow between countries rather than just from the north to the south. And it's very much focused on equity and on bringing mental health treatments to those who need it most. And Professor Patel is really... And his work exemplifies the themes of the meeting. He's written the book Where There Is No Psychiatrist, which is very much used in developing countries. He's led a number of special issues on global mental health, two in The Lancet, two in PLOS Medicine. He started the Movement for Global Mental Health, which is a global coalition of professionals and civil society that works towards achieving the goals of global mental health. He co-chaired the Grand Challenges in Mental Health, which set research priorities for global mental health globally. And recently he was appointed to the Government of India's Mental Health Policy Group, which is tasked with developing India's first national mental health policy. We're extremely honored that he accepted our invitation to speak here, and I really hope that this can be the start of a continuing conversation.
Good morning to all of you, and first of all, my great thanks to Deborah and Witsi and to the organizers of this conference for this privilege, the invitation to speak to you this morning. Friends, I think today all of us, our hearts and our minds are preoccupied by the suffering that we have witnessed on the east coast of this country. But this suffering, the fury of nature that we have observed, reminds us also in the context of this conference about the fact that millions of people in that part of the country will have been exposed to some form of traumatic stress or another. We're also reminded that a proportion of those individuals will suffer from some kind of a mental health problem. But we're also painfully aware that a substantial proportion of those individuals will not be able to access care that we know can actually transform their lives and help them recover. In fact, the unmet need for care for mental health treatments is a global phenomenon. It happens in rich and poor country alike. It is truly a central example of what global mental health seeks to actually address. My proposition to you today is that the only way that we are going to be able to close this so-called treatment gap, to address the unmet needs for mental health care in all populations, is by thinking out of the box about who we consider is a mental health practitioner, who is a mental health professional. And I will argue to you today that in fact we have to think so radically out of the box that we must consider every person in the community as a potential mental health care provider within our broadest understanding of who comprises a mental health care team. Thus the title of my talk, Mental Health for All by All. But first, I'd like you all to humor me a bit. I'd like you to remember I've flown all the way from India to give this talk. So just humor me a bit by, first of all, closing your eyes and imagining a situation that I would like you to think about as I narrate a particular story. So please do humor me and close your eyes just for a few moments, and I won't steal your wallets, I can assure you. I'd like you to imagine that you're a parent of a newborn child, a child that's very precious, as it always is to every parent. You love this child very dearly. This child is 3 weeks old. You've doted on her ever since she was born. 3 weeks after birth, she develops a fever. You're obviously naturally worried, but following the advice of your mother and your aunt, you decide that what she needs is a bit of a cold compress, some soothing, and hopefully the fever will lift in the morning. You put her to rest, and in the morning when you wake up, you discover that her fever, in fact, rather than disappearing, has only become fiercer. She's burning hot, she's looking very poorly, and you also notice that she is having difficulty breathing. You obviously are now extremely anxious and worried. You must quickly make a decision on where you're going to take this newborn pet of yours for healthcare. I'd like you to now imagine the kind of person who you would immediately consult to treat your extremely sick child. And I'd also like you to imagine for a moment the kind of institution in which you would have taken your newborn child. I'd like you to now open your eyes and look at the lady here. And I can be almost certain that none of you would have pictured the healthcare provider to look like the woman on the right-hand side of this particular image. But in fact, this woman, Anjana, has treated and saved the lives of thousands of children with newborn pneumonia in one of the poorest regions of central India, as part of one of the most pioneering examples of how healthcare can be delivered by non-healthcare professionals. As you can see, she's weighing a baby there, but beyond weighing a baby, she has been trained to diagnose and to treat newborn pneumonia in these villages in central India. Now, you might wonder why actually seek help from this woman, who in fact is an ordinary woman from the local community. The reason, of course, is pretty obvious. The people of these villages do not actually have access to any other kind of healthcare. There are no pediatricians. There are no neonatal intensive care units. In fact, there's no choice at all. The choice is really between the baby dying of pneumonia or getting some kind of healthcare from this community worker. Now, of course, many of us would naturally be a little anxious or concerned about the safety of this kind of model of care. And the people who invented this particular model of care, which is called TAR shifting, in fact, the particular program is called home-based newborn care, were also equally concerned about the safety and acceptability of these ideas. And so as good scientists, what they did was they mounted a randomized control trial, in which 40 villages were randomized to receive this sort of community healthcare intervention for newborn pneumonia, which they then compared with 40 other villages in which everyday usual care was provided, which, of course, for most mothers was no care at all, and published what is widely considered one of the most landmark papers in medicine, in fact, one of the most highly cited studies in medicine ever, in The Lancet more than a decade ago, and demonstrated incredibly that these ordinary women like Anjana, when trained and supervised to treat newborn pneumonia, could reduce neonatal mortality by fully 50% in the intervention villages. So impressive were these findings that this particular model of care was then replicated in new randomized control trials in other parts of India, also exported to other countries in Asia and Africa. And incredibly, today, this particular model of home-based newborn care has now been scaled up in many countries, most importantly in India itself. The government a couple of years ago announced the national scaling up of this model of care in the hands of 2 million community health workers providing home-based newborn care for the babies born to more than 1 billion Indians. In fact, this kind of idea of task shifting or task sharing is not unique to maternal and child health. This particular idea has become a very popular strategy to address the human resource shortages across all areas of medicine and healthcare around the world. As these systematic reviews show you, there is now a robust evidence base in support of task shifting in infectious diseases, maternal and child health care, even HIV/AIDS, one of the most complex conditions that one might imagine to treat. And yet today, in many parts of the world, we are seeing non-medical professionals, non-healthcare professionals, providing a specific range of tasks, of healthcare tasks, to address these complex healthcare needs. So, what's the relevance to global mental health? Perhaps it would be a good point for me to just give you a bit of a background. As Witsi said, maybe some of you would be familiar with this field, but perhaps others might not. So I want to spend a few moments really telling you what this field is about. First of all, it's important to remember that the field of global mental health is a discipline not primarily of the mental health professionals, but in fact a discipline of global health. Now, I'm sure most of you have heard the word global health. In itself, it's a fairly new discipline. It's a discipline that in the past we might have once referred to as tropical medicine or international health, but was only actually defined as a unique discipline a few years ago by people like Copeland and others. How does global health differentiate itself from international health, tropical medicine, and its other predecessors? Well, in three key respects in my mind. The first is the priorities in global health are set by the burden of disease of health problems. The greater the burden of a health problem, the more the priority that should be given to it. The second, and Witsi alluded to this, is the notion of fairness and justice, what we might call equity. And at the heart of the equity principle is that of health inequalities. And of course, as we will see later on, people with mental health problems face systematic inequalities in terms of access and health outcomes than people without mental illness. And thirdly is the idea of global solutions. Traditionally, in the medical model, we've often seen solutions being developed in the richer countries of the world, being exported to the poorer countries. The idea of global health is really solutions can arise in any part of the world and can benefit people in all parts of the world. So global mental health really is a discipline of global health itself, and we've defined global mental health in this commentary in JAMA as an area of study, research, and practice that places priority on improving mental health and achieving equity in mental health for all people worldwide. I think the key point here, the key term here, is worldwide. There are mental health inequalities in all countries, rich and poor alike, and the interest of global mental health is to reduce those inequalities in all countries. Now, it has to be said that much of the priority setting, if you remember, I mentioned burden of disease is a very important way of setting priorities. And in global health, a primary metric that has been used to assess priority of health conditions has been mortality. And it has to be admitted that, by comparison, mental disorders do not really kill as often as infectious diseases and some other kinds of health problems, except that, of course, mental health problems do kill in one particular demographic group, which is of great importance globally, but particularly so to the developing world, and that's in young people. This particular slide briefly summarizes the key findings of our national study on suicide in India, which remarkably showed that suicide is now the leading cause of death in both young women and men in India. And indeed, actually, this particular result could also be seen in many other Asian countries, and indeed, globally. Suicide is one of the leading causes of death in young adults around the world. But beyond the impact of a health condition on life expectancy, what we're also very concerned as mental health professionals is the impact of a health condition on the quality of life lived. And for us to examine the combined impact of a health condition both on life expectancy and the quality of life lived, we need to use a different kind of metric to mortality. And the metric that has been invented about 20 years ago to do so is called the DALY, the disability-adjusted life year, which allows us to look at the overall impact of a health condition and compare those with other health conditions. And when one does that, one comes across some startling findings regarding the burden of mental illness globally. We discover that depression is one of the leading causes of the global burden of disease, right at the top of the list, alongside such conditions as infant diarrhea and pneumonia. That when all mental illnesses are put together into the same basket, they collectively account for between 10 to 15% of the global burden of disease. And mind you, this includes the poorest countries of the world. And at any given point in time, the World Health Organization tells us that about 500 million people, about 80 to 90% of whom live in developing countries, suffer from a mental illness. But beyond this burden, let me turn to the equity principle. In all countries of the world, including the richest, people with mental illness routinely suffer disadvantages in their daily lives, and indeed frank discrimination, perhaps most sadly, even within the healthcare system. It is because of these disadvantages that you see figures such as this one. This is a slide demonstrating the gap in life expectancy between people with mental illness and those in the general population in three of the most equitable countries in the world, all three in Scandinavia. To orient you to the slide, these slides, the charts here, the bars, show you the life expectancy gap for three different countries in Scandinavia across different periods of observation over the last decade or so in men and women separately. But I can summarize this by telling you that over the last decade or so, there has been a consistent 10 to 20-year gap in life expectancy of people with mental illness and those in the general community, and this is after taking suicide out of the equation. One of the most probable reasons for this particular gap is because people with mental illness receive poorer quality medical care when they turn up at their physicians. But beyond this life expectancy gap, I have to tell you, in developing countries such as the one I live in, one of the most startling findings is how few adults there are with, for example, intellectual disabilities or epilepsy, even though actually these conditions are very common in children. And one of the most likely reasons is, of course, that children with these conditions haven't survived into adulthood. My guess is the life expectancy gap in places like India and in African countries is nearly half of that as in the general population. But if we look now also at the issue of the quality of care that people receive within mental health care institutions, the story is even more horrific. In most parts of the developing world, the primary form of mental health care that people can access are the mental hospitals, hospitals that were built during the colonial period. And in these hospitals, what you see are some of the most horrific examples of human rights abuses that continue to be meted out to any group in our population worldwide. It isn't surprising then that, in fact, if you had a person with a mental health problem in your family, the chances are that you're not actually going to take them to a mental health service if this is the kind of care that they're likely to receive. Sadly, however, care in the community doesn't also mean care without human rights abuses and discrimination. This image of a young girl tied to a tree or chained to a tree probably reflects the care that many young people with intellectual disabilities and other forms of psychiatric problems in childhood face. We use this particular image as the cover of our article on the Grand Challenges for Global Mental Health in Nature last year. The Grand Challenges in Global Mental Health, for those of you who are not familiar with this, is an NIMH-sponsored project that really aimed to generate the priorities for global mental health for research funders, such as the NIMH. In my mind, the global discrimination against people with mental illness in every aspect of their lives, in every sector of society, is potentially the grandest challenge of all. That's by way of a brief introduction, really, of what global mental health, the inspirational points behind global mental health, what really inspires the emergence of this field. Let me now turn to some good news. The good news is that actually many of these problems can be addressed by delivering evidence-based treatments for mental disorders. And what are those evidence-based treatments? Well, over the last few years, the World Health Organization has been synthesizing the global evidence base on the treatments for 8 groups of mental, neurological, and substance use disorders, including a whole range of trauma and stress-related disorders. This particular program of the WHO called MHGAP worked tirelessly for several years to synthesize this evidence and produced a couple of years ago a synthesis of treatment guidelines packaged very nicely in a 100-page booklet called the MHGAP Intervention Guide, specifically targeting non-specialist practitioners working in routine healthcare settings. And obviously, that would be the bulk of care that most people with mental health problems will access around the world. However, in spite of this extremely important technical development in the form of this intervention guide, the reality is that the treatment gap is extremely large in all countries of the world. Looking at the literature, it seems to me that even in the richest countries of the world, fully half of all the people with a diagnosable mental health condition do not receive evidence-based care in the year prior during their mental disorder. But this treatment gap is even larger in the developing countries of the world, where it reaches an astonishing 90%. And mind you, when I'm talking about a treatment gap here, I'm not talking about mild mental health problems. This figure of 90%, for example, comes from studies of schizophrenia in some developing countries of the world. And I think we can all agree that schizophrenia does represent a very severe mental disorder which does benefit from psychiatric, psychological, and social interventions. Even for this very severe mental disorder, we have an astonishing treatment gap of 90%. Now, colleagues of mine in the first Lancet series for global mental health published in 2007 tried to examine why is it that despite this robust evidence base of effective treatments, the vast majority of people in most parts of the world do not actually receive those treatments. They carried out a qualitative research exercise by asking stakeholders from around the world to understand the barriers to mental health care and came up with these major barriers. I'm pretty sure that all of you will instantly recognize them. To me, these barriers are universal. They're not specific to any one part of the world. The low political will to support investments in mental health care, the resistance to decentralization, and this is a very important part of the proposition I would like to make, the idea that most mental health care must be delivered in institutions, the difficulties inherent to the integration of mental health into primary care, the lack of public mental health leadership, particularly at the planning and the governance levels of mental health care systems. But running through all of these different barriers, I think there's a fundamental barrier, perhaps the most important barrier of all, weak human resource capacity. In particular, the weak human resource capacity in terms of the availability and affordability and access to mental health professionals. Now, let me give you an example of how serious that particular human resource capacity gap is in developing countries. And I'm going to draw upon the country that I have worked in for the last 15 years. India is a country with 1.2 billion people. Now, imagine for a moment if I had to translate the number of psychiatrists that are available in the U.S. in comparison to the population of the U.S., and I had to translate that ratio to the 1.2 billion people in India, we would expect there to be about 130,000 odd psychiatrists. So this is the number of psychiatrists in India, assuming that the proportion of psychiatrists in the population is the same as what you might see in the U.S. In reality, actually, the number of psychiatrists in India is just 3,000, less than perhaps some of the states in this country. Indeed, the number of psychiatrists in India is less than the number of Indian psychiatrists here in the U.S. Now, you might wonder, why have I chosen psychiatrists? I've actually chosen psychiatrists because this is the most numerous mental health professional group. This might also astonish some of you here, that in most parts of the world, psychiatrists are by far the most numerous mental health professional group, not clinical psychologists, not clinical social workers, not psychiatric nurses. So this, in fact, is the most rosy picture of all when one considers mental health professional, the distribution of mental health professionals in developing countries. It's very obvious, then, that if one had to think about reducing the treatment gap in countries like India, one has to think pretty radically about what sorts of human resources one might use in order to deliver those evidence-based treatments I spoke about a few moments ago. It was clear to me that I needed to be inspired in my own work by other areas of medicine and public health, such as the home-based newborn care that I described to you at the beginning. It struck me that if you could train community workers and ordinary people to do something as complex or seemingly complex as diagnosing and treating newborn pneumonia and saving lives, or as supporting people living with HIV/AIDS, surely the same principles could also be extended to the field of mental health. It was this ideology, and I have to say it was an ideology at the time, that inspired me to write this book, Where There Is No Psychiatry, shamelessly copied the title from the classic Where There Is No Doctor, written by David Werner from the U.S. More than 50 years ago. And the idea was that we needed to find ways to deliver evidence-based treatments in the hands of community and other health workers, particularly in places where there's no psychiatrist. Now, when I wrote this book, there was precious little evidence from low-resource countries that actually this particular strategy was either effective or safe. Nevertheless, as Witsi described, clearly there was a felt need for such a strategy in many parts of the world, and the book underwent several translations. However, I think many of us in this room, if not all of us in this room, firmly believe in the importance of evidence, the importance of science to ensure that ideology is always tested in the real world. Today, I'm very delighted to tell you that there have been actually many experiments in task shifting in mental health care from around the world, involving dozens of different scientific groups working in collaboration with partners in the developing world. And I want to focus on three particular examples, all three of which focus on depression, which, of course, is one of those mental health conditions that frequently arises in the context of trauma and loss. The first example is that of Paul Bolton and his colleagues, who worked in rural Uganda. In this particular intervention, they used ordinary people living in villages in southern Uganda to deliver a psychological treatment that I know all of you will be familiar with, interpersonal therapy, but they refashioned this in a way that it could be delivered in groups to make it more efficient, but also, amazingly, that the person who was delivering the therapy was a non-professional, was not even a healthcare worker, and they were trained over 10 days in delivering IPT. They compared this intervention with usual care, which was basically no care at all, in comparison villages. And I'll show you the findings in a few moments. The second example comes from rural Pakistan, one of the poorest countries in the world, where lady health visitors, these are maternal child health workers who work in Pakistan's maternal health care system. They trained lady health visitors to use cognitive behavior therapy-inspired intervention to treat postnatal depression in rural Pakistan. This was also a cluster randomized controlled trial, such as Paul's work was in rural Uganda. And the final example was our own trial in India, which trained lay health workers to become case managers for people with depression, anxiety, attending routine primary healthcare settings in Goa in India. What did these three different randomized controlled trials find? Well, let's first look at Paul Bolton's work. Paul Bolton and his team found that in those villages where there was a trained lay health worker doing group IPT, 95% of people with major depression recovered. In comparison, only 45% of people in the comparison villages recovered, a nearly doubling of the recovery rate in the lay health worker delivered group psychological treatment. Atif Rehman and his colleagues reported a similar sort of effect. 73% of mothers with postnatal depression in the intervention arm, the mothers who received CBT delivered by lady health visitors, recovered, compared to 40% in the comparison arm. Atif's study is particularly interesting and important to me for one other reason. And that is that they were also able to demonstrate the impact on the newborn babies. And what was that impact? They found that the babies of the mothers in the intervention arm had fewer episodes of infectious diseases, for example, respiratory tract infections and diarrheal episodes, and were more likely to be immunized than the babies of mothers in the comparison arm, clearly showing that the effective treatment of a mental health problem has benefits not only for the person with the problem, but also for important and significant others in his or her family. And our own trial similarly reported a recovery rate of 70% from depression and anxiety disorders in the intervention primary health center attenders compared to 50% in the control. Now, the slightly smaller effect size that you will observe in this particular trial was because the intervention was very low intensity. It comprised only primarily of case management and basic psychological treatments as compared to Paul Bolton and Atif Rehman's interventions that comprised of very specific, structured, brief psychological treatments. Now, some of you may wonder, how does this all relate to the particular theme of trauma that all of you are interested in? Well, first of all, it seems to me that trauma and stress are associated, profoundly associated, with depression and anxiety. It could be argued that actually the most common precipitant of depression and anxiety, certainly in the developing world, are traumatic events and losses. The burden of trauma is, of course, a global one, as we've just seen with the sort of disaster on the east coast of this country, but it would be fair to also say that traumatic life experiences are arguably much commoner in low and middle income countries, not least in the context of humanitarian crises that I'm sure we'll hear a lot about during this meeting. But let me turn more specifically then to the trauma-related disorders that many of us work with, essentially PTSD. What is the evidence that one can treat PTSD using non-specialist workers, paraprofessionals, or lay workers? Well, Witsi Tol, who you just heard a few moments ago introducing me, led a systematic review examining the evidence base on mental health and psychosocial support in humanitarian settings around the world and carried out a systematic review of randomized controlled trials examining the effectiveness of interventions for adult PTSD that this table shows. I'm sorry if the results aren't very clear for those of you at the back, but I will summarize the main finding. Of the several randomized controlled trials that they were actually able to assemble for a meta-analysis, the pooled effect size was a mean of 0.38, which I think we can all agree is a reasonably strong effect size in favor of psychological treatments for adult PTSD. Importantly, three or four of these randomized controlled trials involved the delivery of the psychological treatment by non-specialist or community-based health workers, clearly showing that the use of non-specialist workers in delivering mental health treatments also has applicability to the specific case of PTSD in humanitarian settings. Now, if I had to assemble together all these different experiments and task shifting, and mind you, there are many more, I've only cherry-picked a few for the sake of this presentation. If I had to assemble all of these different experiments and task shifting and draw upon what are the lessons, really, what are the common lessons that one can draw from all of these that perhaps we can then utilize in future experiments and task shifting or task sharing, I've coined this acronym called Sundar. Sundar is a Hindi word which stands for attractive. That's what it means. But it also has five different elements linked to these letters. And these elements, to me, are the core elements that make task shifting effective. Firstly, we need to simplify the message that we are wishing to communicate to communities and to community health workers. We need to strip away the jargon that I think surrounds a lot of mental health care and mental health interventions. Secondly, we need to unpack the treatment. And to do so, we need to understand the treatment very, very intimately. We need to understand the patient group we're working with, the disorder, and the treatment intimately. And then we need to be able to dismantle that treatment to identify which are the components or the strategies that are likely to produce the greatest therapeutic benefit, but also equally, which could be, as it were, task shifted, understanding the nature of the competencies or skills that are needed to deliver those strategies. We need to deliver it where people live. Now, if you remember back that image that I showed you of Anjana, the community health worker, and if you remember in your own imagination the kind of setting you would have taken your newborn child, I'm pretty sure the two settings look dramatically different. To me, the real huge difference between Anjana's place of work and the place where we might take our sick newborn babies is that Anjana works in the home of the person with the problem, whereas we take our babies to the place where the doctor and the nurse operates. The whole concept of task shifting is to deliver care where people live rather than to deliver care where the doctors live. We need to be using affordable and available human resources, and that is often going to be different in different places. Obviously, the kinds of people who are affordable and available in the US are likely different from those in India, but the principle remains the same. And the few specialists that we have, such as many of us present in the room today, need to often rethink what our roles are within this community mental health care approach that seeks to expand the coverage of mental health care treatments, a core theme of this year's conference. Now, it's always very humbling to be reminded, just when you think you've hit upon a really great new idea, it's always very humbling to be reminded that actually it isn't such a new idea. In fact, it's been thought about decades ago. And incredibly so, the first place where task shifting was actually thought about was here in the US. In fact, the literature I was then pointed to by colleagues in the US and in Britain on task shifting goes back to the 60s. That's an amazing fact for me. Maybe for many of you, you're very familiar with the literature, but I certainly wasn't. Except that it wasn't called task shifting. That's a new term. old wine in a new bottle, invented by Global Health. It used to be called the use of paraprofessionals, a term that I think instantly many of you would recognize. I was pointed to systematic reviews and trials on the use of paraprofessionals going back to the 60s and 70s in this very country. And the first important review of the evidence of task shifting was carried out by a professor in Illinois University, Joseph Durlach, and published in 1979 in the journal Psychological Bulletin. This was not really a meta-analysis, but it was a systematic review of 42 studies that had been published by 1979 comparing the effectiveness of professionals and paraprofessionals for a range of different mental health care interventions. Now, mind you, this was not paraprofessionals versus no care at all, which is what I've just presented from the developing world. But this was paraprofessionals versus professionals, an extremely provocative comparison, as I'm sure many of you will agree. What did Joseph Durlach find? He reported that paraprofessionals achieved clinical outcomes equal to or significantly better than those obtained by professionals. But this was a very uncomfortable finding for people like myself. It really challenged at the very heart what it was that we spent decades training to do. And as you can imagine, there was a storm in the teacup. There was a lot of correspondence in this journal after that, that Durlach had cherry-picked the evidence to fulfill an ideological position he had, that the kinds of statistical methods he used were primitive, he hadn't actually produced a summary statistical estimate, and so on and so forth. Also, it has to be said, these were not randomized control studies. There was a mixed bag of mental health outcomes. So there was a huge debate and discourse in Psychological Bulletin. So this particular question was revisited by John Hattie and colleagues, and a revised review was published in 1984, which sought to actually address some of the methodological limitations in Durlach's original systematic review. And the most important innovation in this particular paper was one of the earliest uses of meta-analysis and the generation of a summary effect estimate. So first of all, they only obviously used control studies, and they were now going to pull them together to generate a pooled effect size that combined all of these studies into one estimate. What did they find? 154 comparisons from 39 studies, and I'll read out their abstract finding, indicated that clients who seek help from paraprofessionals are more likely to achieve resolution of their problems than those who consult professionals. Now, another very uncomfortable finding. But still, there's a problem with this particular analysis as well, because obviously these were not always randomized controlled trials. And it's very likely and plausible that people who seek help from professionals are sicker. They have more severe mental health problems. They might already have been through a number of other attempts to help themselves. And clearly, these are not genuinely unbiased comparisons. There are confounders here. So the most recent effort to actually address this has looked at specifically comparing people who have a mental health problem but who are randomized to either receive a paraprofessional or a usual care or a professional comparison group. And this was published in 2001 by what's often considered by many of us as the holy grail of evidence-based healthcare, which is the Cochrane reviews. These are very, very rigorous systematic reviews. And in this particular review, which only looked at the developed country literature, there was a comparison of paraprofessionals for anxiety and depressive disorders. Now, this particular review represents an advance from all the previous ones in a number of respects. Most importantly, it focuses on a specific mental health outcome, so it makes interpretation a lot easier. It only includes randomized controlled trials, so any baseline confounders that might exist between the comparison groups are actually taken care of. And it uses, of course, the latest statistical methods to generate summary effect sizes. What was the finding? Well, five randomized controlled trials were found, all from the developed world, mind you, comparing paraprofessionals with a control condition. Now, this is very similar to the sorts of randomized controlled trials I shared with you earlier in my presentation from developing countries. As you can see, the numbers are small, the number of patients when you pull them together, the total size of these trials is actually smaller than even one trial from a developing country. Nevertheless, these are five independent trials pooled together. And again, you see a standardized mean difference in favor of paraprofessionals, which is, in my view, between a moderate to a large effect size. They also found five trials that compared professionals and paraprofessionals. Mind you, randomized controlled trials. Small numbers, but no difference between these two groups. Friends, the particular message, I think, that the evidence base suggests to us so far is, first of all, both in developed and developing countries, the use of non-specialist workers is an effective mental health care strategy to reduce the treatment gap and meet unmet needs for care. And at least under certain conditions, the quality and effectiveness of that care is not greatly different from the care of professionals. Now, of course, many of us, including myself, have a number of concerns about this ideology. The first concern is that it dismisses or downgrades the role of specialists. The second is that it dumbs down mental health care to some kind of very basic denominator. And the third is that it's frankly subversive. Let me take each of these concerns one by one. First of all, I completely disagree with the concerns that it dismisses the role of specialists. In fact, specialists are essential for successful task shifting because you do need a very sophisticated understanding of the particular disorder you are addressing and even more so of the particular treatment that you are dismantling and reorienting in terms of delivery by non-specialists. You can only do that if you have the sufficient skills and knowledge and experience with the disorder and the treatment. Indeed, specialists play critically important roles in all the task shifting experiments, for example, by building capacity, supervising, and critically importantly, by providing referral pathways for those individuals who do need more complex interventions and more specialized skills. So specialists are very integral to all task shifting operations. The second critique or concern is that we dismiss or dumb down mental health care as a whole. In fact, I don't think that's a genuine concern either. What task shifting does is not dumb down mental health care, but it simply makes it more accessible. It expands the coverage of effective mental health care interventions by addressing unmet needs in the population, by reaching out to those people who, for one reason or another, cannot access mental health care professionals. And of course, we all recognize that not only are those numbers large, but they're also unfairly distributed in our population. Typically, it is certain groups of people in every population who are less likely to access our specialized skills. And what task shifting does is it creates a more level playing field by allowing those individuals access to care in a way that's more affordable and accessible. And finally, some people are concerned that it's frankly subversive, that it actually attacks the very edifice of medicine and all the medical professionals. Well, I don't particularly personally have a lot of problem with that, but nevertheless, I again think that that concern is overplayed. In my mind, I'm pretty sure that no one in this room, or indeed in the larger mental health professionals, would disagree with the fact that mental health is too important to be left to professional alone. And if you agree with that particular belief, then actually task shifting is only the practical avatar of that particular ideology. It simply takes mental health care out to the larger population. Nevertheless, we must also recognize the limitations of task shifting. The first limitation is in fact that much of the evidence focuses on mental health problems that we would not necessarily regard as very severe, for example, the psychoses. Where task shifting has been tried with psychoses, the effects are actually quite modest. So it needs to be recognized that task shifting may have a very particular place to play in some particular context and particular types of mental health problems. Secondly, I don't quite see there being a huge tidal wave of support from certain key groups that need to support this ideology to make it a reality at scale. Certainly, there's not much political will to support the idea of using non-professionals, and partly that's because there's not much support from the professional groups. Professional groups in many parts of the world actively contest and obstruct ideas to do with task shifting for various reasons in different parts of the world. There are, of course, practical barriers to actually integrating task shifting. Remember, task shifting does not operate in isolation. Task shifting simply is an expansion of the health workforce. Community health workers must operate within a functioning healthcare system with effective training and supervision. And clearly, that requires active participation of other members of the health workforce, people like ourselves, in order to make task shifting work. And the truth is that there are practical barriers to integration into routine care. At the moment, we have no evidence at all on task shifting for diagnosis. And this is extremely important because obviously you can only receive evidence-based treatments once you've actually obtained a reliable diagnosis. And so far, this is a huge mountain to climb. How do you actually diagnose conditions like PTSD and depression? These are skillful tasks, and to my knowledge, that particular element of task shifting hasn't been fully addressed. And clearly, it's a very important research challenge, an important operational challenge that we need to start addressing very soon. And there is, at the moment, also a very limited evidence base on task shifting for pharmacotherapy. In part, that is because of licensing restrictions in most parts of the world. This would not be even permissible under licensing arrangements about who can and cannot prescribe medicines. And not surprisingly, therefore, the use of task shifting for pharmacotherapy remains a very distant goal. But nevertheless, task shifting to non-specialist primary healthcare physicians, for example, is certainly being done more and more widely, although whether that's as effective as using mental health professionals remains to be seen. So how am I planning to actually work in trying to address some of these challenges? Just as I come to the end of my talk, I'm thinking ahead about the sort of work that I'm engaged with, and a lot of this work is done in collaboration with many people, including some who are present in the room here this morning. One of the areas that I'm very interested to do, and which I think holds a lot of purchase for the future, is developing culturally appropriate psychological treatments that can be task shifted. I'm very impressed by the findings that when you actually use structured psychological treatments, the effect sizes you achieve are much greater than general counseling or case management. Having said this, there's a lot to be said for case management and general counseling because it's even lower cost and low intensity, so even a smaller effect size has great public health significance. Nevertheless, what's also equally obvious is not everyone will respond to that, and there will be individuals who need more specific structured psychological treatments. And so I'm engaged at the moment with developing treatments that can be delivered by lay health workers for severe depression and harmful drinking. We're also working with a team in Britain to develop communication interventions for children with autism. And one of the areas that I think we've explored very little in the task shifting field in the global health context is the use of peers. That is to say, people who share something in common with the person that they're treating. And we're experimenting with the use of mothers in local communities to deliver psychological treatments for maternal depression as part of an NIMH-funded hub in India and Pakistan. The second strategy is to really address this issue of political will and, most importantly, the barrier of integration. As I mentioned to you, one of the great challenges is how do you actually take these sorts of experimental models of care and integrate them into routine care? And I'm very pleased that we're working now with a variety of different partners to actually attempt to do that. The PRIME program, for example, is working in 5 countries, 3 in Africa and 2 in South Asia, in which we are attempting to integrate a team-based task-sharing approach within routine healthcare systems at the district level to improve access to mental health care. I'm also working in the same place where Anjana works. Right at the beginning, I showed you the slide, in exactly in the same communities. We are now working with the same sorts of groups to look at the use of people like Anjana to deliver mental health care in local communities, and that's a program called Vishram. But perhaps most excitingly of all, I'm working with the government of India as a member of their mental health policy group to look at task shifting at scale across the country, and we've just successfully been able to advocate for the creation of a completely new cadre of health worker called a community counselor who will be based in primary healthcare centers and who will deliver a suite of mental health care interventions under the supervision of a psychiatrist or a psychologist who will work at a higher level in the district. Obviously, this is still only on paper, but the financial allocation has been made by the government. Over the next 5 years, one of the more exciting things in my life is going to be to see how this can actually be practically implemented in the real world in India. And finally, something that's a very recent interest of mine is how one can actually disseminate psychological treatments by using e-learning platforms. It's very clear to me, and I'm sure it's very clear to most of you here, that the traditional models of training people and building competencies in mental health care, which is the traditional model of face-to-face learning, is simply not scalable. It's certainly not scalable where I work, and one has to start thinking again about how one can use technology, particularly electronic learning platforms, on how one can actually learn and maintain one's professional competency in delivering psychological treatments through the internet. I want to finish then, and again I'm going to ask you as I finish now to humor me once more by allowing me to speculate a little bit about why I think task shifting is sundar, why it's very attractive, both to me but also to many other people who work in low-resource settings. The first argument, I think, is self-evident. It's simply a utilitarian argument. It's the most cost-effective way, really, in terms of human resources to increase the coverage of evidence-based treatments for mental disorders. It's the most affordable way for governments, for consumers, for a whole range of different stakeholders who must pay for healthcare in all parts of the world. So there's a very simple utilitarian argument in support of task shifting. It's equitable. As I mentioned earlier, the lack of access to mental health care is not equitably distributed. There are inequalities, there are fundamental, there are structural in all societies. And what task shifting allows us to do is to correct at least a little bit those health inequalities in terms of access to mental health care, because you're delivering health care in an affordable and, most importantly, in an accessible way to people. And also, I think there are issues of culture, the linguistic issues and so on. A key element of task shifting is that you're using health workers drawn from the local community who completely understand the community that they serve, which then brings me to the third important reason why task shifting is sundar, is because it's acceptable. For many people, and I think this might be true of all countries, but I won't want to speak about the US since I'm not familiar, but certainly in India, for many people, going to see a mental health professional is not an easy decision to make. It's a decision that's often imbued with a lot of anxiety and indeed quite a bit of stigma as well still. And so to have somebody who is not a mental health professional providing mental health care for many people is in fact a more acceptable way to actually receive mental health care, and certainly to receive care not in a mental health institution. But finally, I think task shifting is also very sundar to me because it's fundamentally empowering to the person who's delivering mental health care. And I want to return to Anjana's story and read out her testimonial. Anjana says, "At first, I used to be known as Ambada's wife, but now I'm well known all over my village as Anjana, the health worker. The villagers have selected me for various posts on many organizations because of that role. I have been respected as I am the health worker of the search organization. I've even given talks about my work in Delhi and Ranchi." This is like going from a remote part of the US to Washington, D.C. to give a talk. "Also, I have got an opportunity to travel by airplane, which I have to tell you in India is something that only about 1% of Indians have the luxury to do, only due to my employment as a health worker. Sounds to me that one of the most important beneficiaries of task shifting is Anjana herself, whose whole status and sense of importance and well-being has been greatly enhanced by her newfound role as a health worker." It seems to me that task shifting is a practical avatar of an ideology of people's health in people's hands, which is a very old ideology, actually, an ideology which in this particular case, this book that inspired me greatly when I first picked it up about 20 years ago, but the book itself is nearly 30 years old, described how in India, the only way one could address the vast inequalities in health would be by actually making health the people's right and a people's ownership. This particular idea of people's health and people's hand is actually very central if we are to actually achieve this particular goal of health for all. Well, by the year 2000, that's 12 years gone. I think many of you will be familiar with this particular iconic slogan. It was made by the ministers of health from around the world who assembled in Alma-Ata more than 30 years ago. More than 40 years later, we are nowhere near that goal. But it seems to me that today, with the ideology, with the promise, with the science that backs the idea that we can expand the coverage of healthcare by utilizing available and affordable human resources, I think maybe that the promise of health for all is now within our reach. But it seems to me that for us to achieve health for all, we will need to involve all in that particular journey. And that is especially true for mental health. And in the case of mental health, I would argue that a particularly important group that we would need to involve are people who are affected by mental illness, both directly or indirectly as caregivers. I'll give you two examples, and then I'll finish, that I have been involved with over the last few years. Empower is an initiative that we launched a few years ago, which involved a partnership between mental health professionals, academics like myself, and user groups. And there were five user groups we worked with in South Africa, in Zambia, in Kenya, in India, and Nepal. And our idea was actually quite simply to understand each other's perspectives and to use those perspectives to be able to improve the quality of our work so that it was more sensitive to the other group's interests. And one particular strategy that we used was, for me as a researcher, to share and communicate the findings of research that I've shared with you this morning to these user groups so they could actually transform this research into messages that they could then communicate to their members and to their larger communities. The voices of people affected by mental illness are far more powerful as advocacy tools than the voices of mental health professionals, certainly in the part of the world that I work in. And Witsi mentioned the second initiative, the Movement for Global Mental Health. This is a virtual platform upon which the vision is that mental health professionals such as ourselves and people affected by mental illness can stand together, as it were, as equals, shoulder to shoulder, and advocate for the rights of people with mental illness to receive the care that we know can transform the qualities of their lives, and to advocate for the promotion of the human rights. I want to finish by acknowledging the very many funders who have played a very key role in supporting the work that I do, and finally, to thank the organization that I work with. This is a very small NGO, a grassroots community-based NGO that I've worked with for the last 15 years in implementing the task-shifting experiments, that some of which I've shared with you today. It's really an example of how big ideas can come from small places. Thank you very much.